Blog Talk Radio.
Yo, check this out. This is Fresh Get Out the China Man with the 2-Live Crew.
Yo, what's up, y'all? It's me, DMC.
What's up, y'all? This is the Blunt Master P.
Yo, check us out. Chuck the Public Enemy.
Yo, what's up? This is DJ Yella from the world's most dangerous group.
What's up? This is DLC.
This is your boy, C-Murder.
This is Jerry Heller, motherfucker.
This is your boy, DJ Paul KOL 365.
Young Busy Ball.
Vice One.
Yo, this is DJ Ready Red.
What up? This is the real Rick Ross. You listen to me on the Murder Master Music Show.
This is a show that shows no limits, broadcast nothing but the real. Interviews with legendary artists, still got love for the underground feel. Rappers with records, reveal the addition of rappers that are coming up, get them put on. We needed a platform to fight the mainstream. The show that you need to be on. Hit up UGS for life on screen and follow up with it.com. For all of your needs, production and mixing and mastering, grab it, just download the time. Check out the archives and touch with the shows. Plenty of content for you to get through. Everything free to download the stream. Oh yeah, we deserve the real.
Unstoppable, we beat, we brought up, it's we represent. All them killers on the mic, and we should love to all your fans. Baby, keep the focus, bringing nothing but the rhythm, come and tune into the dopest.
I'm a man-made guy, crazy, knocking all you rappers off. It's an aggressive society, it's usually just a light dog. Hip-hop AD, representing for the legend. Rapping mumble rappers, so we sitting on the hip. Two pocket beats, dreaming, thank you for the bliss. It's a murder mask, you need to show. Free the homie gangsta bro. I see these rappers on these streets, I got my job about to blow. Stay up on that raw shit, uncut street shit.
Hey, what's up, everybody? It's your boy Prez. You hear the Murder Master Music Show. We just knocked out 600 episodes. We're going to try to give you 600 more. Tonight, I got a special treat for you. This guy is a producer. I know of his work very well, and you should too, especially if you listen to the show, because you know the kind of music we play. Just to give you an idea, some of the people he's laid tracks for, of course, the late, great Eazy-E, Ice Cube, BG Knockout, Gangsta Dre, so of course, the Lynch Mob, WC and the Mad Circle, West Side Connection, the list goes on and on and on. Rakim. But what makes this guy so unique, he's one half of the production duo Madness For Real. This is Nick Colehands. But what makes him unique, I just want to say this before I bring him on, is these guys came to the States, made a bunch of platinum hits. They could have stayed here and continued to do so, but they took their talents back home where they're from, Denmark. I really respect that, man. They came here, they worked with the greats, then they took it back home to work with the greats over there. And that's what it's all about. Let's bring on the one and only Nick Colehands. What's up, Nick? How you doing, brother?
Hey, what's up, yo? Glad to be here.
Man, first and foremost, thank you for calling in. Our show, we dedicate a lot of our episodes to the late, great Eazy-E, and you're somebody that worked with him closely. How did you initially meet Eazy-E, Nick?
Well, we started off as a production company called Solid Productions. We were under management from Solid Productions, and they started doing some tracks for a project called Scared Straight, which was actually a prison program for lifers that they did in Rahway State Penitentiary out in New York. And through that actually got published on a label called Hollywood Basic, which was actually under Disney at the time. And through our contact on Hollywood Basic was a guy called Dave Funkenpine, who was just a cool dude and was very connected with the things that was happening on both the East Coast and the West Coast at that time. And he knew somebody that I actually heard an interview that you did, a guy called Doug Young. And Doug at the time was a street promoter for Ruthless Records. And they connected, and Duff took some of our music and played it for Easy. And this was just after Dre had left from Easy. So Easy was looking for new tracks. And once he heard our tracks, you know, he was colorblind. He didn't really give a fuck. He was more like, he was into the business side. That's why, you know, he was Easy, because he just recognized quality. He didn't really care about your affiliation or your skin color. He was just all about the business. So once he heard our tracks, he said, well, you know, I like that. Bring him over here. He paid for our tickets, and we got on the plane, and the rest was history.
Yeah, you, the first one I heard, I was a freshman in high school, and I actually got suspended because I was reciting Merry Motherfucking Christmas right before Christmas break. And the teacher said, you need to get out of here and go to the office. That song was a hilarious track. Was that Easy's idea, or was that a collaborative effort between you guys and him?
No, I mean, we came in the studio and was, you know, we were down for whatever. And we thought, okay, now we're going to do some, we're really going to do some gangster rap up in this here. But Easy was like, yeah, we're going to do something, but I have an idea for a Christmas song. And we looked in disbelief on him. A Christmas song? Really? He said, well, yeah, I want to do a Christmas song, and I want everybody that's signed to Ruthless Records on the track. So us, we slid. We, of course, agreed to it, and it was just a surreal feeling sitting there playing these Christmas tunes. We were making like classical arrangements in order to replay the samples, because we couldn't sample anything. That was at the height of lawyers and people sticking their noses into samples. So we had to play everything. And I remember sitting there with the guys looking at each other and thinking, okay, we came to the States, we went in the studio with Easy, and now we're making classical arrangements for a Christmas song. I mean, sometimes reality just surpasses your imagination, and that was definitely the case with this one.
Yeah, it was something definitely different at the time. You came into Ruthless right at a volatile time. You know, Dre just left, like you said. Were you guys worried at all that there might be conflicts or beef going down with Death Row at that time?
I mean, LA was dangerous at the time. I mean, we went all over, but I think we were kind of naive because we knew that there was beef and we knew that it was dangerous, but I don't think we understood the magnitude of what was really going on. I mean, you have to understand, we were young boys. We were around 20, all of us. And, you know, we were fans and we were producers, but we were also just young kids. So, I mean, we were so unaffected by what was happening. So, you know, without even blinking, we went to like floss and swap meet and started buying our clothes. And I remember coming swap meet and people looked at us like, either y'all must be crazy or y'all police, one of the two. And but for some strange reason, I mean, I'm not a religious man, but I would have to say that somebody was holding their hand over us, because I mean, nothing really happened. But up until the track we did with BG Knockout and Gangsta Dreista called Dog Pound Killer, when we made that track, I kind of knew, okay, I guess we're not producing anything over at Dre's side, because that track kind of closed that door.
Yeah.
But other than that, though, I mean, yeah, but to us it was just a part of the game. It was a part of the game, you know, that there was this danger element. But I also think, I remember me thinking, well, you know, if I have to go, at least I'm going while doing the thing I love.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. You know what I'm saying? Now that what you're speaking about, for those who don't know, BG Knockout and Dracer dropped the album after Easy had passed, and things were getting crazy at that point. I remember seeing the Method Man at the video shoot talking about the fight with Nate Dogg and the golf clubs. I mean, shit was getting real, real crazy. Nowadays, you know what I'm saying, now that you look back at it all these years later, do you ever chop it up with any of those guys and talk to them? Like, are you still in touch with, like, BG Knockout or anybody from the States
that you work with? Yeah. We produced a couple of tracks for him a couple of years ago. We also did three tracks on Hutch 187's latest album.
Oh, hell yeah. So you've been in contact with these guys all these years. You still work with them. I mean, that's amazing right there. So Ruthless, you know what I'm saying, at this time, I also know that they had, of course, Rhythm D over there, who's also another dope producer. Were you able to work closely with him at all and collaborate with him?
No, I mean, not really. It wasn't like there was any animosity against us. We didn't feel it like that, especially, you know, from other producers. But, I mean, years later, I kind of pieced things together, you know, people, since we were from Denmark, people would just refer to us as Marks. And I kind of thought at the time, oh, that's a nickname. Later on, I found out that Marks in L.A., that's a fucking idiot. So I understand totally that, you know, us coming in there, you know, looking like the way we did, I mean, it doesn't get more white than us. We represented, you know, something that actually was what kind of started, you know, the aggressive feeling in gangster rap, which was, you know, being oppressed by the man. And since we had, it wasn't like we were a part of it, but just our skin color kind of represented something that I clearly see in hindsight could have been a problem. But people was cool, but we didn't really collaborate with any of them because at the time, you know, we were so busy. So we didn't really have time to do that. And you know, but watching, like, Hutch work, watching Rhythm D work, gave us some important pointers on, you know, because they've been in the game for so long. I mean, I remember the first Above the Law album, which I was a huge fan of. So this was also, one thing was working with our idols, such as Eazy and them, but also working with producers that we've been admiring for years also was a crazy experience. So just watching them work was a delight and definitely a blessing.
Yeah, and here you guys are just kids at the time too. That's got to be like extra special. You know what I'm saying? Like you said, you work with all these people that you admire and everything. And Hutch, you know what I'm saying? He's one of the G-Funk originators, if not the originator. What were some of the takeaways that you got from him? You know what I'm saying? Were you able to and were you able to use that in your production to this day?
Oh, definitely. I mean, we come from a sample based culture over here. In Europe, at the time, Copenhagen has actually been throughout the 70s, 60s, and 70s, and throughout the 80s, have been a pretty important jazz landmark in Europe. So for us, it was pretty natural for us to use samples and to use jazz samples that was predominantly used in New York hip hop. So coming over there, we've heard some tracks, but we didn't really understand the culture that was based in the funk music. We loved funk music, but we didn't really have anybody to teach us and to show us the importance of groups like Funkadelic and Parliament and Lakeside and all them groups. We didn't know about this. So first time I saw somebody play an instrument over a hip-hop beat, I paused and I said, you know, we looked at each other and we were like, listen, is that hip-hop? Can you do that? And that was Hutch doing it. But then all of a sudden, you know, we had to investigate and figure out what this was about. Why did they use synthesizers? Why did they do this? What was their take on how they did the music? And like the week after we saw this, we went out and bought ourselves a whole bunch of keyboards and just started playing, because then we kind of saw the connection between the old funk and what was happening with funk in gangster rap. So yeah, I mean, both Rhythm D and Hutch played a huge part in us understanding the whole culture and understanding the way that people incorporated the old funk into the new music, because we hadn't, there was no way that we could have been exposed to that from where we came from.
Well, that's amazing right there. I mean, you got to come over here at a young age and then work with some of the best from this country. Then you were able to take it back home and work with some of the best cats over there. You know what I'm saying? What was it like to come back to your to your country with all these multi-platinum gold plaques, man? That must have been amazing.
I mean, us coming back was it was this was before the internet really kicked off. So when we came back, everything we brought back was new. I mean, we were the first people to, like, little things, like writing your zip code on your hat. We were the first ones that did that. We were the first one that came home with, you know, Ben Davies and Chuck Taylors. We were the first one to come back with that. A third of our production team, a guy called Joker, I remember him coming home, and he had a very distinct style. He had on a hairnet, and he had on a wife beater and a cane and dinky shorts with socks all the way yanked up. And people looked at us like we were from another planet. They did not understand what was going on. And then on top of that, we brought home the funk. And the funk, we only, in Denmark, we don't have a funk tradition, but we have one track that I know that people in on the West Coast has been enjoying for many years. It's Laid Back with White Horse. That track is actually a Danish track. So once we got home, we contacted those dudes, and we were like, listen, we need to do a new version of White Horse. And that collaboration led to the first real funk track, hip-hop funk track in Denmark ever. So us coming back was mind-blowing, but we also had other difficulties, because we were used to having huge studios. We were used to having good conditions. And at the time, hip-hop was, there were certain groups that had success, but it was more like they had a theme that was more, that played onto like more funny stuff and things that was humorous. Where when we came home, we were like, well, that's fine and dandy, but we're not funny like that. We want to discuss things that concerns us, like things that's serious. And it took people a couple of years to actually understand that, okay, you can actually view hip hop in another way, because the mainstream was not on this. They only were into the more commercial, funny type things, where we actually, when we came home, we were cocky, and we went out to all the labels and we said, we're in our home, and just give us 1 million Danish kroners and a Mercedes Benz each, we'll start working. And of course, they laughed us out their office, and we were kind of disillusioned. But then we said, well, you know what though? we got some homies that got some funny money, and we got a hold of on some money and started our own label and put out two records and made a lot of noise. And after those two records came out, the labels all of a sudden started looking into us and thought, well, they got something here. And after 2 years, we got signed to Warner. And the first track we did for our album that was signed onto Warner was, well, maybe our biggest hit that people are actually still jamming to this day. So, yeah, Coming Home was definitely a change of scenery. And it wasn't something that we wanted to. The problem was that our manager at the time, he did some paperwork. We signed some paperwork back in Denmark before we left that kind of stated that we were a part of the company, but it didn't state that he was supposed to pay us any money. So, you know, after the platinum plaque started stacking up at the crib, but we didn't get any money. After 4 years, we told him, listen, either you pay us or we go home. And he didn't want to pay us, so we went home. So that kind of put an end to the whole U.S. thing. So we thought we might have to go back and start something different now.
Yeah, you had to go and create, you know what I'm saying, to build off of that. So it's kind of, you kind of unfortunately got to experience what many artists and producers got to experience in the rap game in the States, which is, you know what I'm saying, people fucking around like that. You know, so that kind of pretty much made you guys want to go back home. Have you ever thought about making a second run here in the States again? Maybe you know, work like you said, doing stuff. You're still doing stuff with BG Knockout. What about coming here and trying to revive this gangster shit, man?
Well, of course we thought about it, but
yeah.
I mean, like the market looks today, it's hard making money. It's way hard making money on no matter where you are. Ever since the internet kind of monopolized the record game, it's just hard. It's hard because now all of a sudden the money is in live and not so much the production side of it. And that kind of puts a limit on the moves that you can make. Because back in the days, we didn't get it, but if you got a couple of cuts on a platinum selling album, you could pay your rent for the next year and the year after that.
Oh.
And the way that things are right now, it's not plausible to actually do it from a economical point of view. But I mean, we would love to go back and do this, but we also have to be realistic and look at it as
true.
A business.
True indeed, man. I definitely respect that. Nick, we're going to go to a break real quick. This is always one of my favorite tracks. MC Ren, you know what I'm saying, I Don't Give a Damn. This was off of his second solo album. He had the first EP, and then he dropped this one right after Easy Passed. You know what I'm saying? And I wish Ren is one of those guys I wish he would come out again. He dropped a track called Rebel Music a few years back. I thought it was phenomenal, and I wanted an album. Before we play this track, what was it like to work with MC Ren, and what was he like as a person?
Well, MC Ren was, you know, first and foremost, MC Ren is a voice. He's an energy. And, you could just tell it's when you're up there, presence wise, like with Ice Cube and with guys that, you know, just when they put their voice on a record, it commands respect. And Ren just had that presence about him. So actually sitting and producing a track and thinking, okay, this might be something, and then listening to the finished results was, I mean, like with so many other records that we did over there, it was just a blessing. It was such a blessing. And Rand is, he's just a dope MC. So so we felt very fortunate that we actually got to work with Rand on numerous occasions. But, I can't stop praising Rand. And still to this day, he has a presence and a voice that just runs through you.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Definitely one of the best. Well, we're gonna play this, and we're gonna come back and chop it up a little bit more. This is MC Rand. I Don't Give a Damn off the album The Villain in Black. If you haven't heard this, you're in for a treat. Classic record.
Who wanna step into the room where that nigga Rand be at? Making shit that's fact. 'Cause in '95 I gotta hustle for your ass. Dropping shit like in the past. Rated double X. You in trouble when I hex niggas that be acting like hoes of the opposite sex. 'Cause fool, I'm a soldier with a regiment. 10,000 niggas marching to your residence. Fuck the president and his red, white, and blue. I never leave a clue with the shit that I do. Sport the black lady creeping with the flashlight. Coming with this fat shit just last night. The mad scientist from the center of the earth. Dropping crazy shit whenever I drop a verse. Niggas in rage wanna see me in the cage. But I got the gauge when the ink hits the page. Fuck a Grammy show and your mammy so now. What the fuck you gon' do when I bust out the zoo? 'Cause you don't know really who you're fucking with. You're fucking with that nigga Rand with the fat shit. I don't give a damn. And I don't give a damn. Trap. What can I do to keep from falling off the map? I ain't your everyday nigga, just with a rhyme. I'll give you that, I don't give a fuck, frame of mind. Make you wanna shoot the police in the back. I'm crazy like Haiti, 'cause devils be shady. The great elephant nigga hanging on blocks. A buffalo soldier without the dreadlocks. I don't give a damn, I created this shit. With the real niggas way back in 87. Niggas walking in my footprints in 9-5. Can't hit a line drive. So get the hell away from my throne or it's gone. My b-boy stands and shit is kinda full grown. Fuck the police 'cause I still feel the same. And fuck a lot of niggas being whack in the game. I don't give a damn. I don't give a damn. Elephant, Remy busting raps, niggas busting caps. The bitch made nigga killer, that's who I be. When bitch made niggas come and try me, a politician kidnapper gives a fuck about him. Nigga never gave a fuck, I can live without him. Niggas wanna journey down the black brick road. They can see me changing and I don't give a fuck mode. When I explode, then I hide your neck. You new whack niggas never give my respect. The center of the earth is where I dwell. Your shit never sell. I got you chillin' in the living hell. So back the fuck out of my way. That's what I'm saying. 'Cause I be having hypocrite niggas, balls hanging. And other bitch niggas be go lickin' them. But riches keep on picking them to slam. 'Cause I don't give a goddamn. I don't give a damn.
MC Rand, I Don't Give a Damn off The Villain in Black. 1996, man, hard to believe that thing is 23 years old, Nick. Does that take you back when you hear some of them old tracks?
Oh, yeah, definitely. you know, there's so many experiences and feeling linked to those tracks. So, you know, listening to it just brings you right back.
Yeah. Hell yeah. Hell yeah. You know, we know you worked with, Ran, Easy, and then you also worked with Ice Cube. You produced a lot of dope tracks for him as well, Down for Whatever, Ghetto Bird Remix, My Skin Is My Sin, a lot of classics. How did you meet Cube, and what was it like to work with him?
Well, I mean, after we started working with Easy and did stuff with Ren, word got out that these white boys had some heat. And we knew that Easy and Cube, we kind of, of course, it was Easy who brought us over. So, but Cube was, of course, also a big idol of ours. So, you know, to pay respect to Easy, we went to Easy and we said, Easy, would it be cool if we were to submit some tracks to Cube? Because, if it would be all right with you, we really want to work with him. And Easy was just cool. He was like, of course, just do your thing. I mean, as long as you keep giving me some heat, you know, you should go out there and handle your business. So we sent Cube some tracks, and Cube liked them right away. So he came over and we chopped it up and started talking. And then we just went to the studio. And working with Cube was, everybody knows that Easy technically wasn't the greatest rapper on earth. He had something else going for him. But Cube, on the other hand, had his stuff locked down in a certain manner that, you know, you can only dream of. I remember coming in to the studio, and we laid the track, because back then, of course, you laid it on 24 track. And we laid the track, and the first thing he did, and this was like 93, he came out with a small video recorder that had a certain line from a movie he wanted to be as the intro. And he said, he was very specific, I want this and this, and I want it in the beginning of the track, and I want it like that. So we sampled it and put it in there. And then when he was ready to do his vocals, he took up machine-type lyrics and brought it into the studio and into the booth, and everything he did in one take. And the track was finished 10 minutes later, and he looked at us, he was like, all right, make it sound good, and left. And we looked at each other like we were touched by a higher force, because we could not believe that after 10 minutes, he had already done a track, recorded it, listened to it, and left the studio. So that was working with Cube. Cube was just being so professional. He was just being so on point with his stuff that it was ridiculous. So working with him, I would say I don't think I've worked with any rapper that was more prepared and more on point than Cube was. He was amazing.
It just sounded like he just handled his business, and he trusted you guys to. He knew the talent that you guys had. He trusted you to finish it up for him. So he just came in there,
yep,
like Pac, just spit his stuff and said, "Hey, take care of it," and just left. Wow, that's dope.
Exactly.
I was just going to say real quick, I give you props too for going to Easy and getting blessings from him to work with Cube, because a lot of cats wouldn't do that, you know what I'm saying? That shows the respect and admiration you have for Easy. So when you told Easy you're going to work with Cube, he was all cool with it, huh?
There was no problem. And Easy was like that. I mean, that is why his legacy is what Easy's legacy is today. I mean, that is why Easy, if you look at, you know, one thing is that he was the reason why there is a Dr. Dre today, and he's the reason why there's a legacy of around Straight Outta Compton. But if you look at just the people that he discovered, I mean, he discovered Will.i.am. We did Will.i.am's first track ever. And he knew this. I remember Will and his group, and they did not look gangster. They were on a totally different path, and it was at times kind of weird to see, you know, and you know how they would fit in. But Easy knew. He knew that Will.i.am had something. He knew that he was talented, and that just goes to show that Easy, he had a sense. He had a sense that not many people have, and that is why Easy has his legacy today, because he had that foresight.
Yeah, yeah. Even back then, and Will.i.am didn't take off to years and years after that. You know, so he knew all the way back then. Wow. So you produced the first track for the Black Eyed Peas.
Yeah. Back then, wow. It wasn't Black Eyed Peas. It was called Atban Clan.
Yeah, yeah. Which later they formed the Black Eyed Peas. But you got to work with Will.i.am right at the beginning. Did you ever imagine that his career would take off to the heights that it did?
I mean, no. I mean, Easy could. I couldn't. But, you know, you could see that the brother really had something, and he was lyrical, and he had a determination that was rare. But, you know, I didn't really look at him and thinking, well, you're going to work with Michael Jackson one day.
Yeah, no idea. Yeah, but that's the beautiful thing about this, because it's you intertwine with so many people, you know. It's just crazy, you know. I hope you get the props you deserve, man, because, like I said, you were the first to work with Will.i.am. I mean, people need to know this. Do you feel, you know what I'm saying, that you kind of get slept on as a producer?
I mean, I don't know if I get slept on. I just think that, you know, we as a production team has never been, it was never about the fame. It was never about really the money. Of course, we wanted money, but it wasn't about that. So therefore, we've never been very good at promoting ourselves, because we're old school like that. We are more oriented towards letting our work speak for us. And, you know, people that are better at promoting themselves usually also get more attention. But we don't really have that aspiration. So for us, I don't know if I get slept on, but it just seems as if when I hear younger generations talk about this, and once they realize what kind of thing happened, that, you know, we traveled half across the globe as white people to do gangster rap at that time, that transition was, it hadn't really been seen before. So I would say, like I said, my aspiration wasn't about the fame, but of course it's always nice to be recognized if you're proud of something that you've done.
Yeah. Oh yeah, definitely. Definitely, you know. And another thing, you were part of the beginning of going back to Ice Cube. You know, you did the first West Side Connection track, which was on Mac 10's first album, West Side Slaughterhouse, with Cube and Dub C and Mac 10. That, did you know when you were doing that was going to be a group at that time?
Not really. We've worked with Dub C as well before that. And we knew that there were talks about that there might have been features on this track, but we did not know the constellation that later on was West Side Connection. We haven't heard about that. But But needless to say, we got a little surprised because yet again, we produced a track that actually had some very strong opinions about a certain group, in this case, the whole East Coast. And that to us was also kind of a surprise because, you know, like with the Dog Pound Killer soundtrack or the Dog Pound Killer track, we now were in a situation where we thought, well, that kind of does it for our career on the East Coast because the way that Cube, especially on the track, is talking about, especially Common. I know for a fact that we're not going to Chicago anytime soon to produce anybody because if they know that we did this track, then there would have been problems.
Especially Chicago. Chicago's like, you know what I'm saying, the gang mecca of the United States, you know.
Exactly.
So that definitely, I could see that, man. So here you are, you guys, you're doing the Dog Pound Killer track out there, but you're just, to be fair, though, you guys are just doing the production. It's not like you're saying to Cube, all right, make sure you do this and do that, you know. You're not the ones calling the shots. But they don't look at it like that in the music industry. They look at it like, well, shit, man, you produced that diss track against us. You're the producer. Did you ever get any threats from any of these guys or anyone ever come at you sideways?
Yeah, well, I mean, of course we saw some shit. I mean, we were in a couple of drive-bys and, you know, there were shots fired through our window, but that wasn't really, I don't know if that's personal or it was just L.A. at the time. Also, because,
yeah.
I mean, the areas that we were in were just high-risk areas. I mean, we would ride around with heat, you know, in the car just to be on the safe side because it was like that back then. And, you know, carjacking at that time was, you know, something that people was really getting into. That was before you can get a lifetime sentence for carjacking. So, I mean, yeah, it was dangerous, but we knew the consequences, and you know, we were prepared to go all the way if we had to. But of course, we did not want to because we had no stake in this. It wasn't like it was our hood or it was our peoples. It was associates. It was people that we worked with.
Oh, so you guys. You guys had to have been like fish out of water. You're coming from Denmark, which is relatively somewhat a peaceful place, I would imagine. And then you're coming into the land of Bloods and Crips, and it had to take some adjusting, I would imagine, huh?
Yeah, well, but on the other hand, I mean, young people, and especially teenagers, because we barely came out of our teenage years. We were, and especially I can only speak for myself, but I was not fond of authorities. I was not fond of people telling me what not to do. So, and I was, my mindset was somewhat hostile. And I could, not towards, you know, the people we were working with, but just in general. And I could really feel that once we got over there, I bonded with people. They could sense that I was hostile, that I didn't enjoy people telling me what to do or, you know, and that kind of gave us not a hood pass, but it gave us some recognition that we weren't spoiled kids, spoiled white kids. We meant this. And that gave us some advantages once we saw also because, you know, you could sense it in our music. When people heard the music, they did not think that it was white people who did this because it was aggressive and it was dark. And once they saw us, they usually people got very surprised. But, you know, we had that in us. But, of course, yeah, I mean, Denmark is a very peaceful country compared to the States, especially California and L.A. at the time. So of course, you know, we need to mind our steps and we need to, you know, shut up and look what was going on. But yeah, of course. I mean, we had some people threaten us, and we had some people, you know, giving us a hard time. But it was a part of it, and we were ready for it.
Yeah, you guys. It sounds like you guys adjusted real good, and you made a lot of acquaintances over here and a lot of fucking hits. You know what I'm saying? The plaques, I imagine, you got to be a collector of plaques by now. Estimation, how many platinum and gold plaques do you have hanging up on the wall?
Well, I think, I mean, we have the Easy 187 Arm Killer. We have Lethal Injection, Ice Cube. We have MC Ren. We have Matt Ken. I would say we have like 4 or 5 platinum and maybe 2 or 3 gold.
Wow. Wow, that's amazing. That's quite a collection right there of history, hip-hop history. You know, I recently heard Mac 10 is putting out a new album, first one in about 10 years or so. Did he reach out to you for production at all? Or?
No, not at all. Not at all. I mean, we haven't been in contact with Mac 10 at all. But, you know, if you hear this, you know, just give us a holler.
Yeah. Is there anybody that you haven't worked with, Nick, that you would like to work with?
Well, I mean, I wouldn't mind working with Snoop.
Yeah.
And from the new generation, I would have to say, I mean, there's a lot of people. I mean, actually, the Bitch Don't Kill My Vibe, Kendrick Lamar, was actually produced by one of my homeboys from out here. Well, let's see, there's many. I mean, I wouldn't mind getting back into the studio with Dub C. But I mean, there's lots that I want to work with, because I really feel that LA has found its voice again, and I think that people like Game and Snoop has elevated the West Coast, and because at a certain point when the whole trap sound, Atlanta sound came in, it seemed as if it ruled everything. And I kind of heard from people over in LA that LA radio had a hard time acknowledging and playing local talent. And they would only play the trap sound, which kind of is sad, because the reason why, or one of the reasons why the trap sound and Atlanta sound had grown to that magnitude was also because that it had local support. And but I really feel that the Game and Snoop has continued to work and continued to show consistency, which now has led to that the West Coast has a voice and an identity, and I love that.
Yeah, the West Coast definitely does. A lot of other areas, they kind of lost their identity over the years, so it's good to see that the West Coast is still intact. I would have thought that you guys would have done some work with Rap-A-Lot. That's another label that I love. A lot of hits came out for that label. Did J. Prince ever get at y'all, or did you guys ever want to work with Rap-A-Lot?
No, I would love to work with Scarface. Scarface has been, all through years, one of my favorite rappers. So I would have loved to do that. No, unfortunately not. But, I mean, again, we haven't been very good at making ourselves seen. So that might be one of the key reasons why that we haven't been contacted by people. But then again, you know, an interview like this is hopefully contributing to people reacquainting with us. So, Jay, if you're listening, give us a holler.
Yeah, most definitely, man. We're gonna definitely bring you up to people that we interview. You know what I'm saying? And because I'd definitely love to see some more tracks. Down to the Last Roach. That was one of those songs right there. You smoke to that song. I mean, that's what it's made for. Were you guys high as a motherfucker making that? What was the vibe like in the studio when you guys were doing Down to the Last Roach?
Well, I mean, Easy was a smoker. And Easy was funny like that because Easy was a real OG. And even though once we came to the studio, once we started working with Easy, he was probably the richest man in hip-hop. But Easy was – he still was so embedded in the gangster life that he would still slang nickels and dimes in the studio. So, you know, they were always working. They were always smoking. And, of course, that track in particular was you couldn't really see into the booth because there was a cloud full of smoke. But it was just Easy being Easy, being legendary, being him. And every track we did with Easy, it would just be it would just have his fingerprint. And that to us was, you know, that was the reason why we did this, was because that working with him and his ideas that at times would have, you know, at first he would say something and we had to kind of grasp what he was saying because sometimes he was he had such foresight that at times you didn't really know what he was talking about until you actually went home and thought about it and then came back to the studio the next day. And then you kind of realized, oh, now I get it. But you know, making that track was just, you know, fun. And Easy was fun. He was humorous. He was always in a good mood. And he is what you hear on the record. He's a jokester, but he's real.
Yeah, definitely. He gone way too soon, you know, but his legacy lives on, that's for sure. Maybe in the future you could work with his kids. They're real talented as well. They've been doing a lot of stuff. I know Little Easy's touring the globe with DJ Yella. So maybe that could happen in the future. But, Nick, before I get out of here, if cats want to get at you for production, what's the best way they can reach you, brother?
Well, you can hit me up on madnessforreal.com.
Madnessforreal.com, and that'll take you there. And I imagine that you guys got, a bunch of info and everything and different things that they can interact with on that site. We're going to put a link. We'll put that link up as well so people can check it out. Remember, madnessforreal.com, people. Nick, thank you again so much for coming on the show. Before we get out of here, is there anything else you'd like to say, brother?
Listen, just appreciate you reaching out, and it's been an honor, definitely.
Definitely, man, and you take care of yourself, and maybe we can do this again in the future. I really appreciate you, brother.
Likewise, brother.
Peace. All right, we're gonna get up out of here. That was Nick Colvans. You know what I'm saying? Madness for real. Make sure to go check out the classics and also see what he's doing today. You know what I'm saying? We'll see you guys soon.